You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 5th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal. In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, on the program today, Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine on a whistleblower's horror story. Also on the program today, my recorded interview with Brian Beutler moments after he exited the Supreme Court after hearing the arguments in King versus Burwell. Also on the program today, Department of Justice report on the Ferguson Police Department is released. This is a police department I don't think it's going to be around for much longer. And as a direct result, two police officers have been suspended immediately, I believe, or fired, I should say. Also on the program today, Senate votes to block union protections. President Obama promises a veto. Alabama Supreme Court. We don't need no stinking badges. No gays gonna get married in Alabama until the Supreme Court tells them otherwise, according to these backward ass. Can I say that about a state Supreme Court? I know I can say that about a state district court judge.
You can say that.
Also on the program today, forget about Clinton. The real scandal is how Obama, or I should say why, he's not going after Boko Haram. We'll let Representative Louis Gohmert cue you in on that. And, of course, Ben Carson's just slow motion implosion. If he makes it through this campaign, I mean, there's a lot of pressure. I think we'll finally get to that report on white privilege as well. Ladies and gentlemen, now, I know many of you may be tired of hearing more about King versus Burwell. I can't seem to get enough of it. And so Beutler's conversation will be the last for at least a little while. We may not revisit this until the spring when this comes back up. But I can't stop reading different theories and takes on this. And I think the reason why this case, again, and I've said this before, but it's not just the 7 to 11 million people who could lose their health insurance. Politically speaking, at least nationally, I don't think it's that big. I don't think it's that big of a deal. In the states, it's going to create a lot of pressure on Republicans if it gets repealed. But, you know, just like when I was saying about the website, we're not talking about a huge number of people in the grand scheme of American politics. 7 million people spread out over 36 states. assuming they all lose their health insurance, are not necessarily a massive political force. Within the context of those states, though, however they are. But again, I think the interesting element of this is going to be to see how the institution of the Supreme Court is viewed after this, if they actually do fine for the plaintiffs. But we'll be talking to Brian Beutler right after we talk to Matt Taibbi. Folks, one ask of you today. It's going to be the same ask I ask of you for the next 30 days or so. And that is, please go to podcastawards.com. Vote for us for best political show. It's an uphill climb. Just as an example, I realize that we're in we're Best of the Left, great show, true dat, is also in the People's Choice. They obviously got more nominations than we did, because we also asked people to People's Choice too, and if they're in both and we're only in one, they got more nominations. So we're going to need you to vote every day. Every day that passes and you don't vote means that we cannot make up those votes. So podcastawards.com, it's free, it's simple, it's easy, and it means a lot to us. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Matt Taibbi.
About it, that's all. We are back.
Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program. Are you a contributing editor at Rolling Stone?
Yeah, I'm not sure of my title. I mean, probably, yeah.
You know,
my status may have changed since I've returned to the company. I'm not sure.
Well, it's as long as you're not sweating it, I don't know. There's no reason for us to.
Yeah.
Matt Taibbi, thanks for joining us today. And I should tell people that you're driving, so if there's some type of accident, you know, be sure to tweet that out, folks, because
this could be a historic interview. So. Yeah.
That'd be good. That would be some serious news we'd be breaking. So, all right, Matt, let's talk about this piece that you had in Rolling Stone 2 weeks ago now, and it really, on some level, is a broader, I guess, a piece on whistleblowers in general and how they fared under Eric Holder.
Right.
And,
yeah.
But it centers on the story of Michael Winston. We talked to David Dayen a couple years ago about this guy, but remind us who he was or who he is and why we knew of him.
So Michael, about, I guess it was 4 years ago now, there was a big documentary. Actually, no, it was only 2 or 3 years
right.
ago. It was a documentary on Frontline. And it was basically a lot of the same stuff that people like me and Gretchen Morgenson from the New York Times have been writing about, which is that, you know, the Justice Department had not brought any major prosecutions against white-collar crime figures, and they interviewed a number of people who had worked inside big financial institutions and had blown the whistle and had seen nothing happen. And one of the first, in fact, the very first person they interviewed in that program was Michael Winston, who was an employee at Countrywide Financial. And Michael had told them some really salacious stories about being at Countrywide. He was an executive from a number of sort of more conservative big corporations in the past, like Lockheed Martin, Motorola. He comes to Countrywide, and he finds out that, you know, the guys are driving around with personalized license plates that say things like fund them, because their unofficial policy is to give a loan to everybody and anybody. And he, you know, he told this story, and he was, like a lot of whistleblowers, ended up losing his job. And what ended up happening was he sued the company for essentially wrongful termination. And they came back on him, and not only did they get the case, the suit overturned, but they went after for court costs and put a lien in his house. And that was the story that I was doing, is that, you know, after the cameras disappear, these guys often have a very difficult time.
And let's talk about, I mean, you know, when that Frontline documentary came out, it was called The Untouchables.
Right.
I don't know if this has ever been explicitly made public, but it seemed to me that Lanny Brewer, the Eric Holder's number two at the Department of Justice, was sort of forced out because of that documentary.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, Brewer had a rather unfortunate performance in that documentary. He, among other things, kind of explicitly laid out this policy that, you know, we sometimes don't bring cases against companies that are, you know, that are really big and that we're worried about the consequences of that. And this was in the wake, it was in the immediate wake of the HSBC and UBS settlements, which were both, you know, crazy settlements for different reasons. Brewer was, he left the Justice Department very shortly after this documentary hit the airwaves, and Holder ended up having to testify before Congress because there were members in both the House and the Senate who were so upset about the Untouchables that they had to hear his explanation, which wasn't too much better.
And did this also precipitate? I can't remember if this followed or actually sort of precipitated President Obama announcing the big federal or the next big federal mortgage investigation squad.
Yeah, the mortgage task force. It's so close to being exactly contemporaneous that I can't remember because the Untouchables came out like the third week of that January, and that was announced, if I remember correctly, in that State of the Union address.
Right.
So yeah, it's hard for me to remember. But it was roughly the same time.
And there was just a lot of pressure, and part of it was, I mean, not all of it, but certainly part of it was Michael Winston coming on and saying like this was not these guys were reckless or careless or this was their business model. Disregard the quality of the loans that we're putting out because we're going to get backstopped anyways.
Exactly. Like, you know, he it's so funny because so many of these whistleblowers have the same story. They see something crazy going on at one of these companies, and then they kind of ring the bell inside the company, and they expect that they're going to be turned into heroes inside the company for sounding the alarm about a practice that they know is going to destroy the company sooner or later, and they find out that actually nobody cares and that they know exactly what they're doing and that this isn't a mistake, that this is part of the business model. Again, I think this is something that we've seen with a number of these people, and that's exactly what happened to Michael. He thought for sure that these guys just didn't know that giving a loan to anyone who could, in his words, fought a mirror, was, you know, bad business. And he thought that they just needed to be educated about that. In fact, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew that they weren't going to be holding these loans, and that it was, very socially destructive behavior, and they didn't really care.
And so you sort of gave us some broad strokes about what happened to him. He won his first case because he was once Countrywide was bought by Bank of America, and they realized internally they were like, "Oh, this guy is really interested in telling us what the problem is with our company. Let's fire him."
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. They sort of just selectively decided not to rehire him. And it was kind of like Office Space, right, where everybody had to apply for their own jobs again with the new consultants who were coming in, and that's what happened. He was not kept on. He sued. He wins a jury award, 10-2, for $3.8 million, and the case was actually so overwhelming that the judge encouraged his lawyers not to bring any more witnesses in the end because it was like, okay, we've seen enough. that was one of the things that I didn't write about in the piece. But, so they had this overwhelming jury verdict and then it gets overturned almost immediately by an appellate court that only took 15 minutes to make its decision.
And they didn't overturn it on traditionally, this is generally how it works, is that when it goes to an appeal, they don't talk about evidence per se. They talk about the law. They don't talk
right.
about they take the facts as stipulated from the trial court, and then they question whether or not the law was applied properly or everybody got a fair trial, et cetera, et cetera. The appellate court didn't do that.
No, they overturned this case on evidentiary grounds, which was really strange. You're exactly right. Typically, appeal involves a mistake of law. You know, a judge makes an incorrect ruling. He allows a piece of evidence in that's not supposed to be brought in. Whatever it is, that wasn't the case in this case. They overturned it on the grounds of insufficient evidence, which is interesting because, again, this is a jury trial where they had over about a month of testimony, and the jury overwhelmingly voted to in his favor. So, on its face, it's kind of an absurd verdict.
What's Winston's perspective on that? I mean, his lawyers say, like, do they have any explanation for how the appellate court ruled that way?
Well, you know, Michael's perspective on this is that these judges were, you know, had political connections, and you know that they were somehow gotten to. I mean, I don't know. I don't know exactly what transpired there, but clearly, it's very rare to see an appellate court overturn a jury verdict unless there's some egregious mistake that's taking place in the trial. And Michael is, you know, understandably beside himself about the entire thing. I think the moment that really did it for him was when they permitted, you know, after overturning the verdict, they permitted the bank to come after him for court costs. Now he's not only lost his job, but he's going to end up in the hole because he had already, by the time he won his case, he had already spent something along the order of $600,000 in court to plead his case. And in order to defend himself, he ended up spending another $400,000 or so. So he spent over $1 million defending himself. And now they were going to, Bank of America was going to come after him for court costs, and they won.
And there's no other court that he can appeal to?
You know, I don't think so. I think that process is over for him now. This to me was the most remarkable part of the story. That what they ruled was that the company could come after him because the plaintiff, Michael Winston, had failed to demonstrate a difference in resources between himself and the defendant, Bank of America. So, in other words, because he hadn't proved in court that Bank of America didn't need the money, that therefore they could go after him for $98,000.
Let me read your quote from the court's ruling, because this is pretty amazing. Plaintiff argues that the disparity in resources between the individual plaintiff, that's Winston, and the defendant, Bank of America, make it unfair to place the cost and the premium on the plaintiff. Plaintiff offered no evidence in support of this argument. It is rejected.
I mean, what can you say about that? I mean, it's, you know, Bank of America is a multi-trillion-dollar company, and you know, Michael Winston's an unemployed whistleblower who now mysteriously can't get a job doing anything.
I wonder if the court just got confused and they could have just been, oh, that Bank of America.
That's right. I thought it was the other Bank of America.
Right. Oh, we didn't realize you were talking about, well, it's too late.
Right.
That's unbelievable. Right. And Winston has since been diagnosed with laryngeal cancer.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So as if, you know, it's one of those when it rains, it pours kinds of stories. He, you know, as he's going through all this, he's diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, when I hadn't been in touch with him for a couple of years when we reconnected over the summer. And, you know, I called him and he told me about what had happened in his case. And he just didn't sound good. And I went out to see him in California, and he started going through treatments around then, but a lot last summer, from what I understand. So, you know, it just tells you about the psychology of these kinds of companies. I mean, they have to. This is all about sending a message. They do not need to get $98,000 in court costs from Michael Winston. They don't need to put a lien on his house. They don't need to keep going after a guy who's got a very serious disease and, you know, isn't in the company anymore. But what they do need to do is, you know, from their perspective, is send a message that there's no forgetting. And I think this is something you hear from a lot of whistleblowers, that, you know, once you make that decision, it can be a lifetime decision.
And we see this, I think, you know, we've seen this, I think, with both whistleblowers who have particularly blown the whistle on the national security state. I mean, people know the story of Thomas Drake and obviously Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning and et cetera. And particularly, you know, I mean, Thomas Drake was simply reporting on what was basically corruption. I mean, not even I'm just sort of like the, you know, sort of efficiencies on some level. and was completely vindicated by Congress, and still his life was destroyed. And so the idea is that whoever's in power is going to make sure that that whistleblowing is there's a clear fear that is instilled in people. I wonder on these type of cases. I don't know if you know the answer to this, but there are key TAM cases where people bring them and the government is a plaintiff. And I wonder if a guy like that could somehow conceivably, because I guess, you know, these banks got bailouts, bring a some type of key TAM lawsuit. I don't know, and it may not make any sense.
Or maybe against the Justice Department for failing to protect these people. I mean that's another. There's another element to this whole thing, which is that a lot of these whistleblowers, they come forward, they know that they're in for a tough time. They know that they're going to have to make personal sacrifices, but they do it anyway, in large part because they expect that something's going to happen. And you know, there are a lot of laws in the books now. That Dodd-Frank has provisions in it that allow the government to give away big awards to whistleblowers. But a lot of the recent settlements were crafted in a way, in kind of an extrajudicial manner, so that they weren't done in court. So it makes it hard for people who are whistleblowers to collect. A lot of these people weren't really protected. They weren't compensated. They weren't treated like, let's just say, witnesses in a drug trial would be treated. You know, and they're. So maybe there's also that element too of, you know, some kind of qui tam, you know, suit for damages. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer either, so I don't know what that would be. But clearly, there's something going on where they're not getting a fair shake.
And I guess to the extent that any of these cases are still winding their way through the Department of Justice, and it may be in this round, much of that has ended. But Loretta Lynch is not exactly does not exactly bring a lot of optimism in terms of these things. Someone's going to replace Holder and pick up the ball and run with it at that point.
No, I mean, she was involved in two of the more disturbing settlements in the last, 5 or 6 years, one of them being HSBC. Again, that was a big drug money laundering case where they admitted to laundering $800 million for drug cartels. And then there was the Citigroup case, which did involve a whistleblower named Richard Cohen, it was no jail time, no indictments, no individuals having to pay anything out of their pockets. She was involved in two of those settlements, and you know, even though she has a pretty good reputation as a litigator here in New York, those settlements definitely give people pause because they're the same kinds of settlements that Holder crafted.
Right, and in some ways, then it's no coincidence she's going to get a nomination, right? I mean, it wouldn't have necessarily guaranteed her a nomination, but it certainly would have kept her from getting one. One has to assume. I mean, if she was going to go out and get all mavericky and actually try and bring cases against these banks, one can only imagine that at the very least, she would be on someone's list of. Not eligible to be U.S. Attorney General list.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and even, you know, how much can she even really criticize, even implicitly, the previous regime for any of these settlements, given that her, you know, that she was the lead negotiator on let's say, the HSBC settlement, which is the one that makes everyone the most nauseous because it was so overtly criminal what the bank was involved with. I mean, this wasn't even fraud. This wasn't even stealing or embezzlement. This was laundering money for Tony Montana, you know, what they were doing. And she, you know, that's the, you know, the worst case that everybody points to, and that's her case, you know? And so, it's really hard to imagine that she's going to take it in a different direction.
So what does Winston do now? I mean, is he basically just trying to put together the pieces of his life back together, or you know, where does this leave him?
You know, I mean, he you know, he's trying to get healthy. I think he's had mixed news about that, I think, recently. And he, you know, he's looking for work, and, you know, it's been a long road for him. You know, he's never not worked in his life before. He says that very often. He's very proud of the fact that he's worked for a lot of big companies and held a lot of important jobs. And again, this is it's a common thread that you hear with a lot of these folks, is that they, you know, it's the fact that they're, you know, a life that they really enjoyed, they're just not going to have access to anymore. You know, you have people like, you know, Elaine Fleishman, who was a whistleblower at JP Morgan Chase, and it's just going to be tough for her to work as a securities lawyer now because she spoke out against Chase. And that's kind of the situation that he's in, is that he's probably not going to have that kind of job again.
Is there any type of, like, organization out there? I mean, I know that there are some organizations that provide support for government whistleblowers. Jocelyn Raddick, we've had on this program some time ago. Is there anything, like, equivalent in the private sector?
You know, not that I know of. You know, there are definitely some whistleblowers who have set up private practices of their own, you know, to help people through the legal processes of their cases. You know, some like Gary Aguirre, who was an SEC whistleblower, he now helps other whistleblowers get through the process. But in terms of, you know, some kind of service that will help them get back on their feet or help them get the, you know, the awards they're entitled to, I don't know if that exists. I don't know if it does.
Do you have a sense, do you know of any people who have come to you and said, look, I'd be a whistleblower, but I've seen what happens, and I'm just not going to go down that road. I'm just going to continue on, do my job, get my paycheck, and not screw up my life?
You know, so I've had people over the last 3 or 4 years say, you know, you can't use my name. I mean, it works out to be the same thing.
Right.
And you know, what ends up happening with that is that I often can't do the story because, it's a huge step. That's why, you know, when these people do this, it's to be really commended, because it totally dominates their lives from the moment they come forward. And that's why they're reluctant to do it. I mean, look at the guy, Greg Smith, who worked at Goldman, and he writes that sort of public resignation from Goldman Sachs as an op-ed in the New York Times. And, you know, instantaneously, the entire financial services industry is making fun of him and abusing him and talking about how he wasn't really a big deal and doesn't know what he's talking about. And, you know, it's going to be hard for him to ever work in the financial sector again. And that's what people are afraid of. You know, they're afraid there's the unknown of what happens once my name's out there.
Matt Taibbi, Rolling Stone magazine, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, buddy.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sam. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Going to take a very brief musical interlude and then come back with my interview of Brian Beutler from just outside the Supreme Court. He filed his story after the oral arguments, ran across the street to the United Methodist building where I was stationed on Radio Row, gave me an interview. Then I have no idea what he went and did. I mean, that would have been prying. All right, we'll be right back after this. We are back on the Majority Report. continuing our coverage of the Supreme Court case King versus Burwell, which involves the subsidies available to citizens who buy their health insurance on exchanges in 34 states in this country, where the federal government had to step in and set up the healthcare exchanges. With me is Brian Beutler, who has literally just walked out of the Supreme Court after hearing the oral arguments in this case. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So give me your sense. I mean, a lot of people, the big deal about the oral arguments is simply it's, I guess, a more... More descriptive tea leaves.
Right, yeah. It's the one place where you can maybe see the justices sort of tip their hands as to how they're going to ultimately rule. In 2012, John Roberts kind of subtly tipped his hand as to how he would rule when he talked about the possibility that the individual mandate was just this generalized tax incentive, and lo and behold, that's how he ruled. So that's the benefit of the oral arguments, and I think that we saw some glimmers of hope for supporters of the law in today's arguments.
All right, let's just start with actually some of the sort of the more practical, mechanical aspects of it. How long are the oral arguments in this case? How many people come sit in there? Obviously, not many people get the opportunity to sit in on a Supreme Court oral argument.
Oh, there were scores and scores of people, including senators, members of Congress. It was packed to the gills. It was at capacity. The press risers were, or I guess the press section was just as crammed today as it was for the 3 days of oral arguments in 2012 when there was a constitutional challenge to the law. So
we should say those 3 days, that was pretty unique. You don't get oral arguments that last that long.
Yeah, the issues in that case were much weightier. They touched on constitutional concerns. This is just a case about whether the technical wording of the law authorizes the subsidies in those 34 states. So they didn't need nearly as much time to bore into the issue as they did back in 2012. But the stakes are almost similarly high in that if the challengers win, the damage to the law will be very grave.
That's right. And so so you go in there, there's the courtroom is packed full of senators, journalists, I guess some advocates as well.
Right. It should be said that the senators and the people who wait in line, they get to sit right in what you might call the orchestra section. I don't know what it's actually called, of the Supreme Court, where they can look straight ahead and see all the justices up on the dais. For the most part, reporters are confined to a section that's sort of behind the curtain and behind these marble pillars. And so unless you're situated very luckily, and I actually had a pretty decent seat this time, you normally can't see anything. You might be able to see a few justices. I was able to see three justices, Kagan, Alito, and Ginsburg. But you're basically, if you're reporting on this, you can't really see very well, and you're generally... You need to do a very good job of making sure that you know what the justices sound like, that you're taking your notes correctly, because you're not allowed to record it. And obviously, since you can't see it, you're not 100% sure who's speaking if you don't know what they sound like.
Wow. Yeah. All right. So there's a certain amount of possible jeopardy for a reporter.
Right.
Okay. So give us your sense. I mean, in the there's 30 minutes for the petitioners, the plaintiffs, to make their case, and that's followed by 30 minutes from the government in this case?
That was the schedule. In real time, the Chief Justice granted the challenger's attorney, Michael Carvin, 10 extra minutes, and that therefore meant the government's attorney, Don Verrilli, got 10 extra minutes. So it was scheduled to go an hour. It probably went closer to an hour and a half.
Okay. And so give us a sense of let's hear what the tea leaves were.
So... It probably won't surprise your listeners to know that since, the challenger's attorney, Michael Carvin, went first, he's positing this case that the Affordable Care Act, both by word and by design, prohibits subsidies in these 34 states. So he encountered a lot of skeptical questioning from the four liberal justices. For the most part, they dominated the questioning of him. He was bailed out a couple times by Justices Alito and Scalia when he kind of found himself a little bit trapped by their questioning, but for the most part, the first half of the argument was those four liberal justices expressing incredible skepticism of his argument.
And the skepticism centered around what?
Well, several things. One, the idea that his construction is the only reasonable one, that it says subsidies are available through an exchange established by the state, appears clear unless you look at other parts of the statute, which say that if a state doesn't establish its own exchange, then HHS will come in and establish such exchange that you can just substitute in.
Okay, so they're reading those four words too narrowly.
Right.
They're not looking in the context of everything else. That's one line of attack. My understanding is Ginsburg also raised standing. Is that right?
Ginsburg raised standing, but both in his response to her questions and then when General Verrilli addressed standing, it seems like the standing issue has been resolved, that at least one but probably more of the four plaintiffs have standing. The government didn't really dispute it, kind of left it hanging as a question for the challengers to address. They said they didn't have the information to know for certain whether any of the four were subject to the mandate in 2014, and that's the question for standing. And the General Verrilli settled later that yes, indeed, at least some of his clients were indeed subject to the mandate in 2014. So that's a standing question. So that was one thing. They made pretty short shrift of that. Liberal justices were very concerned that that the challenger's reading was too narrow, that it created a series of very severe anomalies elsewhere in the statute, that it rendered the scheme largely unworkable. That was sort of the core of it. But the most important part of that first half is that Anthony Kennedy, one of the conservatives, chimed in to say that he believed that the challenger's construction of the statute would make it unconstitutionally coercive.
Okay, so just to recap here, from the liberal perspective, the idea was by isolating those four or five words, you're not taking into the broader context of the law. Also, this would render the law basically dysfunctional, and there is a typical hesitancy of the courts to do such a thing to the legislation.
Correct.
The idea that the intent couldn't have been this way. The even language aside, why would Congress ever pass a law that was doomed to fail from the beginning? It's like building a car and saying, which specifically you're not going to put an engine in or drivetrain.
Right. There was a good analogy to the idea that Congress could say that states must create airports. If not, the federal government will come in and build such airport. You would resolve the question as to whether one was a state-established airport or a federally established airport if the government then said you can only land your airplanes at an airport established by the state. Well, obviously, that would have to encompass all airports. Otherwise, you have these useless airports.
Right. There's no reason to do that. So two or three of the questions raised were sort of generic on some level or broader principles.
Right.
One was the way in which I guess all three were just sort of broader principles.
Justice Breyer was very explicit that he thought that this was a very clear-cut substitution issue, where you have a term of art, an exchange established by the state, where the preference is for the state to establish that exchange, but that if the state does not do so, then the federal government will come in and establish such exchange. You just plug federal government into that other part of the statute, and you've resolved the supposed conflict.
And then Kennedy comes in with the principle that actually at least left hundreds of thousands, I guess maybe millions of people without Medicaid.
Right.
Made that principle, which is this idea that if the federal government had intended to punish states by not giving them subsidies, that would be too coercive, as if they were saying, if you don't take the expanded Medicaid, you don't get any Medicaid.
Well, his argument was actually farther reaching than that, because he wasn't just concerned about the loss of the subsidies, right? He was concerned about the imposition, therefore, of an unworkable regulatory scheme. If the subsidies disappear, then for most people the mandate disappears, and without a mandate, you're left with this requirement that insurance companies sell insurance to everybody and rate the cost of the insurance based on how healthy the overall population is, but you don't have enough customers to make sure that system works. You have just sick people in the pool. So his concern was not just that these subsidies would disappear for the people, but that the state would be saddled with this unworkable system and that it is not rational for any state to accept accept a death spiral in their insurance market, and that is just coercion.
Okay, so that the idea of trying leaving the state in that situation is coercive of the federal government, right?
Right.
Are you also suggesting that he was like saying that it would be regulatory overreach by the federal government to inhibit the sort of the business of insurance companies?
Here's how I would put it.
Is that sort of a bank shot?
He's very concerned about making sure that statutes don't upset the sort of federal state balance, that the federal government isn't trampling on states with its laws. In the case of Medicaid, that was basically just about money. Either you take this Medicaid expansion or you lose all of your Medicaid money. Was coercive because it just gave the states a sort of a Hobson's choice. They couldn't really turn down the expansion because too much was at stake. But that was basically all about money. In this case, his concern about the intrusion on the states is partially about money and that the subsidies would disappear for state citizens, but also that the regulatory regime or artifact that would be left behind by a state declining to establish an exchange would be disastrous for the state, and that the state didn't have any notice of this. This is not a very generous way to treat states, and Anthony Kennedy is very skeptical of laws that or interpretations of laws that intrude on states in that way.
So, as far as asking the challengers, the plaintiffs in this case, any other sort of more pointed questions, Scalia, Thomas, well, Thomas doesn't say anything anyways, but Scalia, Alito, what about Roberts?
So we know that the four liberals, they all seem very skeptical of the challenge. And we know that Anthony Kennedy seems skeptical of the challenger's construction of the statute, which is good because the four liberals aren't enough to save the law. You need a fifth. So it looks like it could be Kennedy, but if it's not Kennedy, it could be Roberts, because Roberts, I think this is unusual for him, he said almost nothing throughout the whole oral argument. He wasn't quite as quiet as Clarence Thomas, but he spoke up only to sort of direct traffic and make sort of one kind of cute remark, and that's it. He didn't
like to call boxing balls and strikes.
Right. I suppose it would be unusual for him. I think he has a tendency to sort of pepper attorneys with pointed questions when he's intending to, or when he believes that their argument is susceptible to an adverse ruling. And he said nothing. So he clearly wants to keep his cards close to the vest.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't really tell us anything about how he'll ultimately rule, but he's a wild card, right? So you have the four seemingly locked-in liberal justices, Anthony Kennedy sort of suggesting that he wants to avoid this unconstitutional reading of the law, and so he might, therefore, buy this other argument, and then maybe Roberts. So you have a universe of six justices that could vote to sustain the subsidies. Alito and Scalia seemed like lost causes. Their knives were out for Obamacare right away. It's hard for me to imagine that they'll turn around and say, actually, the government deserves deference over these subsidies. Could happen, but I doubt it.
And was there anything that was equally as revealing during the questioning of the government, when the government came up, when Varelli was there? I mean, it sounds like...
Well, yeah.
It makes sense to me, to a certain extent, that the challenger would be... That's the most telling exchange, although it depends. I mean, I think there's been occasions. I feel like the last round, the some of the justices were almost carrying the plaintiff's argument into the argument with the government more forcefully sometimes than the plaintiffs were.
In both cases, both attorneys needed help at various points. Michael Carvin, the challenger's attorney, seemed to need a little bit more help, and he got bailed out by Scalia and Alito. One time that I can recall off the top of my head, I forget which liberal justice came to his aid. Both attorneys did a pretty strong job overall in presenting their cases. What was most revealing during the government's argument was that Roberts spoke up again, and he, without being prompted, he said... If you'll allow me, I could even just pull up the exact quote.
Of course.
I have it here. If you just give me one second. He said, if petitioner's argument is correct, this is just not a rational choice for the states to make. and that they're being coerced, and that you then have to invoke the standard of constitutional avoidance. So he said, without being prompted, that, you know, he's not certain that the challengers have the better read on the statute. But if they do, if they have the only correct or plausible read on the statute, they still shouldn't win because
he'd adopted Kennedy's argument.
That was Kennedy.
You said it was Roberts.
I apologize. Okay. No, Roberts was very quiet throughout the thing. This was Kennedy. He spoke up again, and that's what he said.
So people are clear, what Kennedy is saying, that even if the plaintiffs were to prevail on their interpretation of the statute, that would move the statute into an area where it would have constitutional problems because of this dynamic.
And that it's incumbent upon the court to avoid interpreting a statute in a way that renders it unconstitutional. That was something Kennedy said on his own. He wasn't nudged in that direction, or he wasn't responding to anything that Don Verrilli said. He kept coming back to this point that I don't like this construction because it's very coercive.
So now you can't see the look on Scalia's face when Kennedy raises this, right? Or Alito.
I could see Kennedy a little bit.
I mean, do they know, and I don't know if you know this, I certainly don't, but do they have a sense of, when Kennedy goes in there, I mean, I imagine that Alito or Scalia has a good sense of where Alito is on this going in there, to the extent that they even need to question where Thomas is. I have a sense that they would know. But do they know that Kennedy's going to say something like this? Do they know that Kennedy's been going around the halls going, I don't know? I mean, or
my sense is that they all say very little to each other before the arguments, but that everyone knows this about Kennedy, that he's a stickler about this federalism issue. The interesting thing is when conservatives first identified this term, exchange established by the state, it was before the IRS said subsidies go everywhere, so they were prepared to argue that the law made subsidies conditional on states setting up their own exchanges and that this would be coercive. And they liked that argument because they knew that it would appeal to Kennedy. Fast forward a few months, the IRS says subsidies go everywhere. Now they flip and they say they want to enforce that coercive property of the law, which just flips Kennedy's position. Suddenly they're asking the court to impose this very coercive structure on states, and their concern becomes not winning Kennedy over but not losing him because they're positing such a coercive read.
Interesting.
Of the law.
So the same principle they thought could cut their way, and then they realized in practice it doesn't.
Right.
Wasn't Scalia? I mean, presumably there were four people, right, who signed off on this. We don't know who they are. And it's conceivable one of them was a liberal justice, right? So saying, I'll do you a solid, Scalia.
Conventional wisdom is that since there was no need for the court to take this, that the only reason it would have taken it is if there were four justices who are really primed to overturn the King ruling in the Fourth Circuit, which upheld the subsidies. I think smart money's on that it was the four justices who voted to declare Obamacare unconstitutional back in 2012.
So that includes Kennedy.
That includes Kennedy. Now he sort of sees the entire picture.
So Scalia leave the chamber and walk down the hall and just look at Kennedy and just go, what the F? I mean, what?
Yeah, we had a job to do here. It could have been Roberts. There's also a plausible sort of minority opinion that, because this is such an important case, because they knew they were going to have to pick it up eventually, because as time goes on, the law gets more entrenched, it becomes harder to decide.
Let's run it through now and get it out.
I'll
tell you why that doesn't seem. Why would they have to get it eventually? Because eventually there would be a circuit court that would split.
This was going to come up through basically every circuit court in the country, probably. And the standing argument, while slightly convoluted, there are people who, if you buy the challenger's argument, they get hurt, right? Because they either have to buy insurance.
There's going to be people out there, even if these four, didn't even realize they were part of the case, or were subject to the VA or Medicare or whatever it is.
And you saw with the D.C. Circuit that there were two federal judges there that were willing to void the subsidies. Now, that decision got voided itself.
Right.
But there you had evidence, clear evidence that this thing was going to go up into the through the court system, and that there was a decent likelihood that there would be a split, and that the Supreme Court would have to take it anyway.
So maybe,
now, like I said, that's a minority view of why this case was granted.
That actually makes the most sense to me. That somebody said, "Let's just rip the Band-Aid off this thing, get it over with, instead of letting it dangle out there."
It's highly plausible. Most court watchers take the alternate view, but it's not a crazy idea.
Well, at least that clears the decks for Benghazi.
Exactly.
So now we don't have to worry about that, assuming, of course, that the indication that you got from Kennedy, and I've seen this echoed at least, that people seem encouraged walking out of there, at least, you know, the people that I'm encouraged to see encouraged.
It was striking how much more forceful he was about this constitutional issue than he was about the language of the statute or anything else. That was his core concern.
Wow. All right. Well, there it is. Brian Beutler, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. That was my interview with Brian Beutler. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have sound from Ben Carson and Louis Gohmert and Chris Matthews and and some good sound. And Fox News military analyst, maybe. I don't know. Folks, just a reminder again, podcastawards.com, podcastawards.com. You can vote every day. Check your email address, because if you haven't voted before, sometimes they send a verification email to you. It'll take a second. We need you to vote every day, because already we've lost a couple of days in this thing, and frankly, there's some heavy hitters out there who I think we may have a tough time beating. And there's nothing worse. There's no worse feeling than going from best podcast to not best podcast anymore in politics. Like, I don't buy this whole better to have won and then lost than have never won before. No. This is a what have you done for me lately type of business. So it's like, well, yeah, back in 2013, it was a good podcast, but not anymore.
You all know how it feels like to not win a podcast award. I'm talking about the audience.
Well, not having won. That's the real tragedy.
That's
so,
true.
Folks, please, podcastawards.com. See, I'm not even going to mention any other thing you can do to support the program, because this has been so crucial to us. I mean, and the idea that we would no longer be the best podcast, political podcast, when at the very least the show has maintained, if not gotten better. I don't want to place ourselves beyond best podcast. Like, I don't want to transcend that, because then that people might say, well, I'm not going to vote for you for best podcast anymore because you're better than that.
Oh, no. We're not better than that. We're exactly right for that.
That's
so
what I'm
please
saying.
Vote
so
for
we've
us.
We've been in like
yes.
a holding pattern
steady
to a
state.
Slight increase in quality.
Well, just as the quality of our competition and intensity of it has maybe increased a little bit, so have we increased a little bit.
Our quality has definitely increased. It's just that, you know, there's some low-hanging fruit that sometimes motivates other people. If there was a section of podcast awards on covering what many people think are arcane Supreme Court cases, best coverage of our somewhat arcane Supreme Court cases, we walk away with that one.
That's very true.
But they don't have that award. That
but seriously, if you value Sam's emotional well-being, please vote and vote often.
And even if you don't, even if you want to do it to spite me, that's fine too, because then you could set me up for next year, which would be even more crushing.
That's right. Play the long game if you want to upset Sam.
That's right. So if you want to do me a solid, you got to go vote. If you want to make me feel bad about myself, you vote. You set me up for like 2016 or 2017. I don't even know if I could take it after 4 or 5 years. after like 6 years of winning in a row and then we lost, that would be devastating.
There's still a little bit of rationality left here. So you got to get us the win this year to really set us up for that sucker punch.
The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Cue music.
I am.
646-257-3920.
Once again, that's a vote for the best
right.
politics.
Well, we don't get best produced.
No, I gotta cue up the music.
I know. That means you got to touch the board. So when your hands are here, that means you're not touching the board.
Especially when I play this second version of La Poupée, when they start off with, fuck off, I need to...
Well, so much for that, right?
Right under the wire. Right under the wire.
I am me.
Perfectly timed.
VR app at majorityapp.com. It's a free app. You can also IM me through your instant messaging client at Majority FM or call the program 646-257-3920. We'll be back in just a moment. She's a pretty who says no. Just a little dog, and she knows I love her so. If I ask her to walk with me, she shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little dog who says no. Ask her to walk with me. Why can't she ever see? Says you're only afraid to lose.